Hi, everyone. Well, I'm very excited today because I'm going to have tea with my friend, Mark Knopfler, who is, as you know, the most amazing guitarist, songwriter. Actually, he's been called a virtuoso of his art, which I totally agree. And you know him through Dire Straits and many other wonderful musical adventures. Anyway, I'm looking forward to talking to him. I hope you enjoy it. Hello, Mark. How are you?
Hello, Twicky. How are you? Nice to see you again.
Thank you. Well, we've actually seen each other quite recently, haven't we?
Yeah, we had a little social evening with the partners, and I think you were wondering how on earth you were going to get rid of us. And we were all out with Bill Wyman and Susie as well. That
was a great night.
And I think that's why we were so late getting to bed that night.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't too, I mean, not like the old days when we used to fall into bed at like 3 a.m, but it was not too bad. It was about 11-ish, wasn't it?
A lovely evening, yeah.
It was. Well, thank you. It was smashing. Well, thank you for joining me. Have you got your cup of tea?
Yeah. No, actually, I've got a cup of studio coffee because I've just purchased a new coffee machine here, which is it the proper Italian thing, and it cost about £1 million. So you just have to make sure it's doing what all the things it says it does, and it is delicious coffee.
Is it? I mean, does it actually make a difference?
I'm not going to say what make of coffee machine it is.
Well, you can if you want. They might send you another free one. Do you drink tea? Actually, I read in your bio that you drink tea on stage. Is that right?
Well,
used to.
Not anymore, but we used to just tell people it was tea.
What was it?
It was tea.
And it was tea.
Yeah, it was. But no, Guy Fletcher, who I work with in the studio here, when we're in the studio, makes a seriously good cup of tea, and it's always PG tips, by the way, if anybody wants to know.
Oh, that's interesting.
And he tries to train the juniors in, because we always have a lot of youngsters working in the studio, lovely kids. And I don't know whether they'd appreciate being called kids because they're all grown-ups, but they're grown-up kids to me. And it's quite a complicated process. I mean, it's a sort of a feel thing. Guy's got this very relaxed way of making it that he has shown me, and I retained about 80% of it, and I can never quite duplicate Guy's
tea. So it's not just a tea bag in a mug?
No, I'm not trying to get out of it. You know, that's the thing. Because we've got people here who refuse to make it because they can't come up to Guy's exacting standards. You know.
That is hysterical.
Yeah, and there's an old guy who works here as well who was actually in the time of, you know, EMI and George Martin. He was the first young guy in the studio to refuse to wear a white coat to operate the machinery.
Oh, did they wear white coats?
They did.
Why?
Isn't that something? Well, I suppose they were technicians, and to be a proper technician, you wore a white coat. And he said, it's easy making tea. You just get a tea bag, you put some boiling water, you drop it in it, you drop it in the cup, and that's it.
Well, I think that's how most people make tea.
Does
Guy make it with tea, you know, proper tea leaves in a pot?
No. But even his method with the PG tea bag is quite...
I shall have to ask him. We're going to see him soon. Because he lives quite near us in the country, and I shall get him to demonstrate his tea making.
Yeah, and you're going to be doing a bit of recording with Guy down there, is that right?
We might be.
I hope you do, yeah.
Yeah, he's a very nice chap, but we've only recently met him as well, so I don't know him very well, but he's always so lovely.
He's a lovely man, and he did a sterling job on this Teenage Cancer record. That because he's technical, because he's a recording engineer and came up the way recording engineers do come up. I mean, he has slept underneath the recording consoles when he was growing up, you know, and so it's nice and warm down there. But he's done it all. And so we actually has my back in the studio. So we seem to be quite a good little production team.
A good little production. But he's also, he plays keyboards as well, doesn't he?
Of course he does.
Yeah, he's brilliant. And
so he'll bring his keyboards into the studio, and so they'll be at the side of him while he's also manning the console and doing 101 other things as well as supervising tea.
Now, before we came on air, you started singing a song and I said, oh, who was that? And you said Roger Miller, and I went, oh, yeah. And you started to tell me a Roger Miller story, and I stopped you. So can we carry on? Because I Roger Miller.
Well, I was, I was over there staying with Chet Atkins, and seeing a bit of Chet Atkins, who became a good pal of mine. And there was a night for a country singer, his name escapes me just at the moment, they were saying there was a little party for people, and Waylon Jennings was there. And I do remember Roger Miller turned up like in a white Cadillac, and he was a wonderful guy. There was something really magnetic about him when he spoke, and he said something nice about my guitar playing or something. And he said, there's something real beautiful and true. And it, the way he used those words together, beautiful and true. Oh. And then he sort of whisked off into the night at the end of it all. But it was almost like, it was like a movie president is what he was like. I thought he could do anything. He's such a charming man. He could do anything that he wanted to do.
How brilliant. Because I'm a huge country music fan, and I know you are. And actually, yeah. I mean, obviously Dire Straits is I love and always have, but I love the stuff, the Shangri-La recordings you did with mm-hmm. Emmylou Harris. They're beautiful.
Thanks very much. But
so I presume you're a country fan too.
Yeah, and you know, a country fan and blues fan too. So I just came at the whole thing, and you know, I just try to absorb the entire thing. And actually, as the years went on, I got a little bit older and you know, got into the acoustic side with a friend from Leeds, Steve Phillips, who had a National Steel guitar. And so that led me, knowing Steve, led me down into a whole lot of other music, drug band music, and that I wouldn't have normally.
I've never. What did you call it? Drug band? What's
jug
that?
Band.
There's oh, jug band. Music, I thought you said drug.
Where instead of a bass, you had somebody playing on a jug. And
really?
Yeah, just blowing for the bass notes, you know. That's very, very early. Some music from the 20s, music from the 30s, and then Western swing music and other things. So it's just part of an education, really, and knowing Steve, because Steve had a record collection, which I certainly didn't, and so I got to hear a lot of stuff. And then you realize who, although I had blues heroes from the 60s and 50s and stuff that I was listening to before, I then found out that the blues artists that influenced them. So, you know, you'd say, oh, I always loved Howlin' Wolf, for instance, but at Steve's house you could hear the people who influenced, you know, Howlin' Wolf. And then you could hear those influences. And so that was putting bits and pieces together as part of the love of, it just kept build up the love of music, black and white.
So did he get all that music from America? I mean, we're born the same year, aren't we?
We kind of
grew up in the same time. And I don't remember. I mean, I can remember my elder sisters playing pop music and kind of, I remember Bill Haley coming over. I must have been quite small then.
Oh, yeah.
And rock and roll, that. But I don't remember, I didn't learn about country music and all that until I was much older and went to America. And
well, that's right. There was a couple of specialist dealers, and there was a shop called Dobell's on Charing Cross Road. And, you know, so when I first started going down to London, because London had me in its spell, you know, it enchanted me as a kid. I don't know whether it was the same for you.
Well, I kind of grew up in, I grew up in the suburbs, but I was a Londoner.
But yeah, so. But you got into the, occasionally you would get into to the smart, you know, you'd see.
My mum, we'd call it going up west to the West End.
Yeah.
And we go up on a Saturday and it was a thrill. We go up on the bus and we go to Lion's Corner House. Did they have those up north? In Newcastle, I don't know.
No, I don't think so.
Lion's Corner House, which was really a cafe, but to me as a little girl, it was like, it was on the corner of Marble Arch and Oxford Street.
Yeah, I've read about it in fiction.
But on a Saturday, Mum, well, not every Saturday, but we'd go out there and we'd have sausage, chips and a fried egg. And I thought that was really amazing.
Live it up, eh?
Live it up. You were born in Glasgow, though, weren't you?
Yeah. Actually, I'm half, I suppose I'm, my dad was from Hungary and a refugee in 39, and he met my mum, who was a Geordie, from a Geordie family. But they were actually Scottish Geordies, really. I mean, they were Geordies. A lot of Geordies came down to the northeast from Scotland to get involved in the shipbuilding that was going on Tyneside and the heavy industry and stuff like that. So if you look at my ancestry thing, the English side of it, the British side of it is really a lot Scottish. It's, you know, it's absolutely almost like half Scottish.
So did your dad, you said he was a refugee, was that because of what was happening in Germany, the Nazis?
Yes, he was Hungarian refugee, Jewish refugee. And He never talked about it. When he talked about it one afternoon, one day, he was just idling. It must have been a Sunday afternoon, and I was just listening, and I got the story. But he didn't make a big deal of it. He was a lovely chap. I mean, absolutely adored kids, and so I had a fairly happy childhood in Glasgow, and then we went to Newcastle when I was about 7 or 8, and. Because his job took him down there from Scotland, so I was broad Scots when I was a little kid.
You had a Scottish accent and everything.
Yeah, and then became Geordie more gradually. Yeah.
Was your mum or dad? Were they musicians? Or I mean, where did you get that kind of love of
I think they were musical, and my mum could play the piano a bit, but. It was really the radio. It was the BBC. It was Listen with Mother and Children's Favourites. And I used to listen religiously, I mean, every day. And I asked my mum about it, and she said, you'd sit on the floor and listen really intently. And so it was a great grounding. There's all kinds of music. And right now, because the lyrics meant a lot to me. I was listening to the words, so I can still sing. I could sing songs when I was 18 months and like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
When
stuff.
You were 18 months?
Yeah.
Wow, that's really young.
And I sang with a lisp. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. And had a very shiny nose.
Oh, how brilliant.
And I can still remember the words to a lot of these songs. So the lemonade springs, the soda water fountain.
Oh, God,
where the bluebird sings and the lemonade springs on the big rock candy mountain. So the big rock candy mountain. And I could go on singing it now if I was in the mood to punish you. But I know the words to a lot of comedy songs.
So that's interesting. You got into the lyrics more because I love lyrics, actually.
As much as the music, you know, as much as the music.
Because my favourite female artist is Joni Mitchell.
Yeah.
I mean, not apart from her amazing voice, but her lyrics are just, I mean, course. She's a poet really, isn't she?
Yes.
Well, you are as well. I mean,
I got into all of them. But I can still sing, I don't want to boast, but I can sing a Bernard Cribbins song from beginning to end. And people look at me, you know, sort of thinking it's a bit weird, and it probably is. I think you've got to be slightly obsessed with songs, you know, and that's so obviously when Chuck Berry came along, he was a brilliant wordsmith. It all resonated with me big time. So I was just a youngster, but I was still, and I was mad about Boogie Woogie and rock and roll from my Uncle Kingsley. And I was mad about the Boogie Woogie, and my Uncle Kingsley played Boogie Woogie piano.
Great name, Uncle Kingsley. Was that his name, Kingsley?
Yeah, that was Mum's brother.
That's a brilliant name.
And it was great fun with that. But when I heard Boogie Woogie, those three chords, it just was like cosmic for me. You know, these big, big blocks of logic just sailed into place.
There's usually a moment when I've talked to people like yourself, there's usually a moment or a person in their life that kind of does the twist to make what's going to happen to them happen.
Yes, and then that was the moment for me. It was This Is For Me. And, you know, and much to the disappointment of lots and lots of people that had to put up with me banging on the floor with Boogie Woogie piano for a really bad piano playing for a long time. But that's part of coming up. I just couldn't get enough of it.
When did you get your first guitar?
I had to wait until I was about 15. I couldn't afford one like Hank Marvin's, which was a Fender Stratocaster, and they cost a lot of money. But my first one was almost like a little imitation style of red solid body guitar, a Hofner, which cost about 50 quid. And but that was quite a big, that was a stretch. But I'd pestered my poor old dad for so long that I didn't have the nerve to ask for an amplifier. So I just used to play it, you know, at home with no amplifier. I'd put my head down on the guitar a lot of the time and I'd had some chord diagrams, you know, like the cowboy chords.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so I never went up the dusty end because I didn't know what happened up there. So I just stayed down near the neck and played the cowboy chords.
So how old were you then?
I'd be 15, 16, and then a couple of years later, I started singing with a girl from school who I taught to fingerpick. And I'd learned to fingerpick a basic folk-type fingerpick from a folk singer in Northumberland who was the boyfriend of my little mate's big sister and who wanted to be a folk singer. And me and Vince, who was my little pal, we'd sing Everly Brothers songs and try and harmonise, you know, along with the Everlys. The Everlys became, and I realised, of course, that you could hear it, that they'd been a big influence on the Beatles.
They were a huge influence on Paul McCartney, who's a mate, I'm sure you know him.
Oh, yeah.
And he loved the Everlys.
Yeah.
I think they influenced so many people.
Yeah, I adored them.
Do you think it was because they were brothers? Their harmonies were so amazing. It was almost like one voice.
Yeah, a lot of the mountain bands, a lot of the singing groups in America were family groups, you know, and I think that was definitely a factor. But sometimes your voice can just go with somebody's when Emmylou and I sang, somehow it would work occasionally if I had the higher harmony, actually. But they, sometimes you just get something that works. And actually, Emmy and I didn't get much time to record at all. But I do remember a particular day, which is like a full circle moment. I think I've had a few of those where I was doing it. I was part of a Chet Atkins television special at Vanderbilt in Tennessee, and he got me in the band, and Chet was there, but the Everlys were guests, and Emmylou was a guest, and the Everlys sang the song Why Worry, which was a song that I'd written probably influenced by the Everleighs in the first place. And that's what you call a, what I would call a, one of those moments when they're singing your song and you're in the band and it's a woo-woo, yeah, one of those full circle moments, yeah.
Well, you must have felt that when Tina Turner did Private Dancer as well. Yeah. Because you wrote that, didn't you?
Yeah, and when the Shadows did the theme from The Local Hero as well, which was
that's
nice.
Right.
And to be on stage with the, because, of course, Hank used to get up with us when we, at the end of our set, and play the Local Hero theme quite a lot.
Lovely. Was he a big influence on you as a guitar player?
Huge, huge. I'd be behind my desk at school doing and doing all that stuff, and the teacher would go, "What are you doing with that, making that metallic noise at the back of your throat, boy? get out." And, you know, so things, I was lost to rock and roll. I was absolutely lost to it. And the first record, speaking of Paul McCartney, the first record that I bought with my own money was Please Please Me.
Yeah, I remember it well.
And I was just, I was enchanted by that, you know. I must have played it and played it and played it.
The first record I can remember seeing as a record, my middle sister's 7 years older than me, and it was Paul Anka's Diana.
Oh yeah.
And she'd bought it and she brought it home, and we sat around the dining table holding it and looking at it because we didn't have a record player.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was amazing.
Well, that was the same thing. I was like that with an electric guitar. I didn't have an amplifier, you know.
And I just thought it was amazing. And we'd heard it on the radio, so we knew what it sounded like. But
yeah.
And my dad took pity on her eventually, and he managed to get a second-hand. Do you remember those little dance set?
I was just going to talk about them.
Blue and Cream. And
yeah,
he got one from a mate at work, secondhand.
Vince's sister, Francie, she used to bop, you know, in the house. She used to dance and jive. And that's an early memory of Francie jiving to that dancette, you know, to her dancette record player with Ricky Nelson songs and just the whole thing bopping away like anything. And that's the biggest part of the whole thing, yeah. It was just a total love affair with it, and I was totally consumed by it. I used to fall asleep playing, and Mum and Dad used to say, "Come on, come up, you've got to go to school tomorrow, get up and come upstairs," you know, but I would be downstairs playing, and I'd fall asleep playing later on. I got into this habit of falling asleep playing, and I mentioned it to Chet Atkins, and as soon as I met him, I said, "You know, I used to fall asleep playing," and he said, "Me too, exactly that." That he was doing exactly the same thing. Because what's happening is that your fingers are wandering about on the necks even as you're nodding off. And what's happening is you're sort of finding your way. Because, you know, with a guitar, it's kind of a bit perverse because down in the cowboy position, you know, what I call the cowboy chords, it goes one way, but then
is that in the long neck of the guitar?
Yeah, it's down by the head, down by the head of the guitar where the tuning pegs are. So your basic early chords that you learn, but then when you start playing in the middle of the neck, the fingering is different, and that's what holds a lot of people. Oh, hang on, I'm not doing this, because the fingering changes, and then you go up to a third position, and the fingering is slightly different again, obviously, if you want to play the same thing.
So you completely self-taught? I mean, you didn't have guitar lessons at school or...?
No, not really, no. I mean, Joe, the Francie's boyfriend, taught me to finger pick, and then at Steve's house I would have learned a few more complicated picks, you know, where I'd be getting into ragtime and stuff, and it just got a bit more sophisticated here and there. And never as sophisticated as Chet, was just magic. But, you know, for just a little Brit strummer, it was getting, it was getting a little bit more complicated. Because the thing about finger picking is that you can accompany yourself with your thumb, you know, and you're picking out a melody or trying to pick out a melody with your fingers at the same time. So it's click, clickety, clicking along.
When did you actually start writing songs with lyrics. Did that kind of happen hand in hand, or were you playing other people's songs first?
Yeah, you've got to do that. You've got to do that. I think you just got to copy like anything. Copy, and then eventually something may or may not emerge, which is like a style of your own.
I'd say because you, I mean, lots of, I think you'll agree that lots of bands can sound the same, but your sound is so unique. I mean, you know immediately it's you. When Dire Straits came out, I mean, it was a new sound. Like Bowie was a new sound, you know what I mean?
I had a, you know, most guitarists play with a plectrum, you know, with a little piece of plastic, and I just would keep losing mine. And in the end, I just stopped using it really because my picking wasn't as loud as a pick. It wasn't as loud as a plectrum, but it had its own mood, and you know, I felt quite intimate with the guitar, with the ends of my fingers rather than a piece of plastic. So it's a disadvantage actually in a lot of times. So I tried to keep going with the pick as well, and occasionally I'd have to get an acoustic guitar and strum a rhythm part or something. But a style developed, and a sort of style, because I was breaking the rules. I was bringing my fingers from the high strings down to the low strings and joining up with my thumb to make notes. So any guitar teacher would look at that and just make a face. You know, it's not what you're supposed to do. And the other thing is that my hand on the neck was all wrong, because to teach it properly, you have to get your thumb round the back of the middle of the neck and bring your wrist round. And to me, that was just too much. I just took the easy route and I just would hold the neck like a plumber holds a hammer, you know, and that's what I do. And I wouldn't use all my fingers and all the rest of it. So every lazy habit, you know, it's all in there, and I'm past help now.
You past help. Well, thank God that happened, as we wouldn't have your music. When you write a song, does the music come first, the lyrics, or does it kind of all happen together?
I wish I've been asked that, you know, so much. It's a good question. I don't know how quite know how it happens, and sometimes things happen at the same time. But sometimes if I've written a section A, a section B starts wanting to just stop the boredom of it. So a section B sort of says, hello,
that's
enough, enough of that. It's my turn now. So, you know, and that's how songs have bridges, and what musicians call bridges and middle eights, you know. And that's how they happen, or they don't happen, you know, as well. And there's a lot of times, but if it's not happening for me, I don't worry about it. I just put it in the junkyard and wait until it wants to be. I mean, so sometimes I'll leave a bit of a song just hanging there for years, and it doesn't want to be. It doesn't want to be finished until it's ready to be, until its time comes.
It's not ready to be born.
Right, exactly. Yeah,
it
is like
that. They are like your babies, aren't they?
Well, they are, because
they come from within you. And
yes, because you try and do the best thing by them, and then you watch them going out the door and down the road to have a life of their own. And so you try to do your best with it, you know, and so do all the lovely musicians who play on it. You know, the song comes first, and what you're all doing is you're not that there to show off to each other. You're just there to, it's probably like rehearsing a play where the play comes first, and you take whatever part is necessary to make it work, to make it that little bit better. And it's not about how loud you are or how big you are or how much you've got to say. It's just sometimes the part that a musician will settle on, and I certainly don't tell my guys what to do at this stage now. I mean, they're so great. So all you're doing maybe is a bit of directing traffic later on, but you're certainly not giving precise instructions to great musicians, just like I'm sure a director wouldn't do it to a great actor. You know, you wouldn't last very long, probably, if you started, if you started taking a top actor and saying, now, what I'd like you to do is
go,
you know.
Can you imagine doing that to Robert De Niro? No.
Yeah, go over there and scratch your head and, no, exactly. Excuse me. No, so, no, I don't think he'd have much of a career.
Your brother, David, is it David, your brother?
Yeah, makes his own records.
Was he one of the first people you started Dire Straits with, is that right?
Yes, and John Ilsley. They were sharing a flat in Deptford, and I was working up in Essex at the time.
Because you were a teacher or a lecturer, weren't you?
On the outskirts of London. Well, that job saved my life because I didn't have a gig at the time, and the mother of an old friend of mine said there's a vacancy in the English department. So I interviewed for it, got it, and I'd found a room to live in Buckhurst Hill, and at the end of the Central Line, and I could then buy a motorcycle and stuff like that, and I was mobile, and then I bought my dad's old car, and then I could get the guitar and the amp in it and move around, and just because I was really the songs, I'd realized that I was becoming somebody who wrote songs. I didn't think of myself as a songwriter at all. I thought I was just a guitar player and not a very good one at that. And so the songs just started writing. And I think from being a newspaper man and being out in the world, and it had given me a few ideas to start writing about. And I realized that I was putting together, in a very haphazard and unorganized, disorganized kind of way, songs, things that, and then I started to finish them, make them into songs. And so I became a songwriter really painfully and gradually. And it was just being in love with all. I was in love with the, you know, because when I was a kid, I was listening to Bob Dylan and going to his concerts and things like that. So that was influencing me, being a songwriter. And that sort of starts to transition.
And am I right in thinking that, was it Sultans of Swing which really kind of exploded for you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it did.
And I can remember that coming out. And again, it was like a new sound. It was like, you know, we'd never heard anything like that.
Well,
it
a
didn't
lot of
sound
people,
like anybody else.
I used to listen to Charlie Gillett on Radio London. He had a program called Honky Tonk on Sundays, and I used to listen to it. And I said to John, "Let's, because we'd made this 8-track tape of half a dozen songs, and I said, let's just send it to Charlie Gillett and see what he makes of it." And of course, Charlie played it on the air, and then the story is that people were,
how brilliant!
What people as talk about what they were doing and what they were, and we never heard it actually because we were moving furniture for a friend on the day that Charlie played it.
Your big moment, and you were moving furniture. That's so funny.
Yeah. So right said Fredding, you know, and you know, that was a hit all over the world, and we were living in this little council flat in Deptford. And the contract, our record contract, was that we'd get some royalties in 18 months. You know, so we were still living in the flat, and we, you know, and everything like that,
so
for a
funny,
long time.
Isn't it?
So it's a long,
yeah,
it was a long time.
You had this massive hit.
Yeah,
no money.
Around the world, actually, everywhere except for England, because the England had a Radio 1 had a committee which decided what the records that would play, and they judged. And there was a woman called Gladys or something who was in charge of it all. And they turned it down. They turned Sultans down because
oh
they said...
Oh, my God. Like Decca turning the Beatles down, right?
They said, no, not exactly. But
well,
they did say close. It had... They said it had too many words, which was quite right, you know, and... I once said to an American engineer I was working with in New York, I said, Shelley.
Yeah.
Shelley was eating a sandwich. I said, why are my songs so long? He said, you got a lot to say.
Yeah, that's brilliant, isn't it?
So but there were too many words, and I probably wouldn't write it quite the same now, although I'm still guilty of doing that. But yeah, it did, and that made a big difference around the world, and we were in a position where then you just had to pick up the ball and run with it. And you've really got to want to do this, you know. You've got to really. It's the same as, and I know you're very familiar with the same thing, Twiggy. You know, you've got to. It's for the ones who are there, who turn up, who don't give it up, and there's lots of bits of it that. You know, some kids, you'll say, well, he's got the this, he's got the that, he's got the this, but he hasn't got the final bit that just makes you turn up and be there and kind of see the whole thing through. And you can always kind of feel that.
You still do tour, do you?
No, actually, I've just given it up.
Did you love it when you did it? Or
loved
was it?
Totally made for it. I loved it. Loved it.
Because some... people I've spoken to either loved it or they loathed it.
No, I loved it, and I loved rehearsing too. I think rehearsing is a great time for me, and actually in many ways it beats the performing, because that's the rehearsing is when you're discovering things, turning them round and round and having a look,
yeah,
seeing
exactly.
what you can do.
Although I haven't done the concerts you've done. I've done a few concerts in the past and I've done some stage shows, but there is lovely about that audience feedback, isn't there?
There really
that
is.
That you don't get in rehearsal.
That's
and
true.
That is true. And you do feel it coming across, you know, from the auditorium. And I'm sure in a concert, it, you know, like you do, it must be amazing when you've got those thousands and thousands of people.
You can almost feel
the warmth, can't you?
Oh, yeah. And how it feels in the hall, in a big venue or a big venue, it's quite extraordinary, really. And I've discovered early on that I like playing in lots of different kinds of places. I like playing in round venues, and there's that feeling of the arena, you know, the circus. Quite liked all that, and
didn't you record an album in the Montserrat studio in George Martin's? Because that got destroyed, didn't it?
The volcano.
But
I do remember being there. I've got some great memories of Montserrat, and I'd written this song called "Money for Nothing," and I'd based it a little bit on. You know, there's an advert. MTV were doing adverts for themselves, and they had people, had artists on saying, "I want my MTV." And so I'd seen the Police doing one with Sting and Stewart and those guys, and we'd done lots of gigs with the Police. You know,
we'd done lots
going round together and. We just share the whoever went on first, you know, who went on second.
I had Stuart on a couple of weeks ago.
Great.
He's ever so funny. He's a great guy.
I had a good time with Stuart. And but anyway, I was in an electrical store in New York, and the story of the song is, you know, there was a big brute of a man in there delivering something, and. He was holding forth about, because all the TVs in the store were tuned to MTV, and he was just commenting on the, you know, look at that, you know, that ain't working and all that stuff, you know. Maybe get a blister on your little finger, you know. So I was recording the song, and I said, I was in the studio at Montserrat with the band, and I said, I wish Sting was here because I'd written I'd copied the notes from Don't Stand So Close to Me for this little bit of the song, you know. Uh-huh. You know how the Don't Stand So Close to Me, do, 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 don't stand, do, don't stand, do, 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 do. So I wanted that for I want my, so I was, you know, obviously, you know, that was going to give Sting a royalty, of course, for stealing his, like that line. But anyway, I said, I wish Sting was here. And somebody said, well, he is here. He's on holiday.
Oh, that's so funny.
I said, you're kidding me. And Corneille went down, bothered him pulled him off the beach and said, hey, come on, come on up there. He just came straight up to the studio and he sang the song great and he just jumped into it, you know, and it was just transformed. So he was fantastic, a fantastic feature of the song. And the song wouldn't really be the song, if it hadn't been for Sting. So
but isn't it lovely that happened organically and it was just, he happened to be there. I mean, I love things like that. It's brilliant.
Isn't that good?
Yeah, amazing. You produced Bob Dylan's Infidels album, didn't you?
Yeah.
Was it amazing working with him?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and we'd worked on one before as well. And so we got to know each other a little bit. And then I did that. And then later on, I did a couple of tours with Bob in America and Europe. And so it's just been nice, you know, and touring in the winter as well as the good weather. So it's it was just it's just a part of the whole experience. Again, those full circle moments, you know, a bit like the Why Worry, you know, it's a full circle moment. It's because, you know, I was just thinking when I was a kid and 12, 13, listening to his first album, and just getting him and then being in Newcastle to see him perform at the period when he was going electric and half, you do the first half acoustic and then second half electric and people were booing and I thought it was all fantastic.
Wow. Why were they booing?
There was a considerable opposition to, you know, his switching to electric music,
wow.
You know, which I thought was, I was in love with the whole thing, of course.
Aren't people weird? You'd think they'd just be thrilled to be seeing Bob Dylan, whatever he did.
Well, it was loud.
I did meet him once in LA at a what's that club on Sunset? It was a famous club that did...
The Roxy. That's where I met him. I actually met him at the Roxy.
Maybe it was.
He came to
concert and he was in the audience.
All right.
And somebody introduced us, I just said hello because I was just so overwhelmed to meet him. It was like when I met Joni Mitchell, who I love.
Yeah.
And I'm not usually stuck for words, as you can probably tell. But when I met Joni, it was like, oh my God, it's Joni Mitchell. But she was absolutely gorgeous. She's sweet, sweet lady.
Yeah. I tell you who is another lovely lady I like from that part of the world is Bonnie Raitt. Don't know whether you've ever been
at her. I don't know her. Is she gorgeous?
She's gorgeous. She's
great. She's a great performer. Wow. Not bad.
No, she's a lovely girl.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah. Actually, of all the, I mean, I've met some amazing people in my life and career, and most of them turn out, there's one or two that weren't very nice, but most of them are really, really, really lovely people.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
That's right. You know, it's so funny because I was at a sale of some of my guitars.
I know, we were there. That was a brilliant night. We weren't there at the sale. We came to the launch of it.
Yeah, and when I'd said a few words, and as soon as I got down from the stage, there was Joe Brown.
I know, you know, I saw him.
And he's such a lovely guy, and I've known him for years, you know, donkey's years. He's wonderful. And he was one of the first people I ever saw playing live, which was at Newcastle City Hall, where Del Shannon came round,
wow.
and Joe was on that tour. and somebody wanted an autograph from him, and you know, and he said, "I've got to go in. I've been in a bit of a hurry. I've got to go in," because he'd obviously he was down the set. You know, he'd be starting the set quite early. So he's the first British rock star that I saw, Joe. And anyway, I'd given him a guitar, and I like giving guitars to people I work with, and I'd given a guitar to Joe. Anyway, a while goes by, and then the postman arrives with a handmade wooden rocking horse that Joe's made for our kids.
Beautiful.
And isn't that wonderful? It's a whole side to Joe that I never knew about.
Amazing. Now, you've got a new album coming out, haven't you, soon? What's it called? Or has it got a title yet?
One Deep River.
Ooh. When does that come out?
I think it's April.
Oh, lovely. Oh, that's exciting.
I think it's April.
Very exciting.
And as you know, as usual, I've taken far too long to make it, but and it's so, yeah. And how is it? It's slow. And so it's true to, you know, it's true to form. I just do everything slowly. I'm gonna have to speed up a bit. I think next record I'm gonna have some rockers on there just to make it go the other way. Yeah.
So I was there the night you did your lovely chat and launched the sale of the guitars at Christie's. It was a fabulous night. And was it a sad moment selling the guitars, or was it? I mean, it's lovely because I know you gave a huge chunk to charity. Which charity did it go to?
Oh well, no, there's a bunch of charities that I've been involved with for a long time, but the different charities. But there was one charity, there was one guitar in there for which it is the teenage, you know, cancer charity over here, and it's 50-50 between that charity and the teen cancer in America, which is the sort of American equivalent, and the money's gone split exactly between the two in terms of that. And the guitar for teen cancer was jointly, you know, that was bought by the teen cancer, and we all signed it. Lots of players signed it and have done the same thing for the American guitar. Well, I sold for over 400,000 in the sale. And
well, I'm not surprised. I'm saying her, but I'm not surprised. My goodness. But they must be like your babies. Did you feel sad, or was it just, I mean, I know you've got lots of other guitars, but.
Yeah, but they're your friends, you know, they're your friends. So you've loved these things. So, yes, I mean, things that you would have gone bananas for as a teenager, you know, you've got a white Burns Bison, you know, which is like, it's as rare as hen's teeth. And then there's the bass, you know, which goes with it. And it's like, wow, 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 have you seen that, you know? And so there's part of that, the little fan. You know, it's the little fan. I used to go up to the front of the stage, went gigs, and look at the instruments and the amps, and I was obsessed by all of it. So, I just think it's nice handing it over to somebody else who will give it a home. You know, because when it sits in a case, it just gets dusty.
Yeah. Now that's a lovely. I did read somewhere that you said, "I just hope people who bought them play them and love them like I have."
Exactly.
And that's love, yeah.
Chet Atkins said to me about the guitar, he said, "It'll be the best friend in your life."
Oh, I bet you that's true.
And he was right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, my little granddaughter, who's 8, she's learning guitar at school. And her mum, my daughter, plays a little bit. Well, plays quite well, actually. And I said to Joni, her name's Joni, I said to her last week, you know, if you stick to this, and it will be your best friend, because you can take it with you. It's not like a piano that you can.
When I went out of the shop holding it in my, you know, with my dad, the old guy in the record in the music shop in Newcastle said, "Stick at it," you know. So I did.
Oh, lovely. Well, on that note, That's brilliant. It's been so lovely. As I say, I could go on for hours, but I'm not allowed to. We have to keep to a certain form.
Yeah, you're gonna wonder how to edit that lot.
That's Kobe's job.
Well, stick at it, Kobe. I hope you get there.
Oh, Mark is he's such a lovely man, and it was so interesting for me listening to. I love when I hear how people got into what they got into, you know, whether it's being a singer or a guitar player or any sort of musician or an actor. It's fascinating, and I'm really excited about his new album, so look out for it. I think he said it's coming out in April, and it's called One Deep River. That's something to look forward to. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed listening as much as I enjoyed talking to Mark. Anyway, I'll see you soon. Bye. If this is your first time listening to Tea with Twiggy, please do remember to tell your friends. You can also subscribe for free on your podcast app and listen to all my previous guests. If you want to connect with me, I'd love to hear from you. You can find me on Twitter at Twiggy, or you can find me on Instagram at Twiggy Lawson. My thanks go to all the people that have helped this podcast happen. Many thanks to James Carroll and all the team at North Bank Talent Management. Thanks to all the team at Stripped Media, including Ben Williams, who edits the show, my producer Kobe Omanaka, and executive producers Tom Wally and Dave Corkery. The music you can hear now is my version of Waterloo Sunset by The Kinks. If you'd like to hear the whole song, you can find it and all the other songs I've recorded on iTunes and Spotify, so check it out. I look forward to you joining me for my next episode, so see you then. Bye!
Just heard a Stripped Media production.